This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Madeline Jenner, coming to you from Sydney on Gadigal land. Welcome to This Week. It started with a cyclone warning.
If you live in any of those regions, you need to be ready for a cyclone to cross the coast. Destructive wind gusts of up to 140 kilometres per hour are forecast.
But when Cyclone Jasper hit the Queensland coast just north of Cairns, it took almost 5 days to move west, dumping more than a metre of rain and devastating communities.
This has all been our house all through here.
Many residents found themselves rescuing neighbours as the water rose.
OK, we got you, mate. Can you get down?
Yeah, for sure. I'm all cramped up.
Yep.
Gavin Deer was one of those rescuers. He was helping people out of trees from his tinny in Rossville, south of Cooktown, as the water rose around his own house.
We couldn't get right to the house, but we saw, you know, when we were arresting that fella, we were seeing bits of our house floating, floating past. And the scale of destruction is immense. It's catastrophic down here. We're used to cyclones, floods every year, but this flood, mate, it was something to behold.
The cleanup is underway and the damage bill is expected to run into the billions. But it's left many asking how a low-level cyclone can cause so much rain, particularly in an El Niño year. Jonathan Knott studies floods in northern Australia. He's a professor of geoscience at James Cook University and a Cairns local.
So I've been to all of the major flood-affected areas around Cairns. My understanding is that there's hundreds of homes that have been impacted. I don't know exactly how many, but there were a lot. There's big piles of ruined household items, furniture, curtains, fridges, washing machines, all out on the footpaths ready for council to pick up. People have been in there working pretty quickly and trying to clean up. Fire and emergency are there, police are there, and the people are very, very happy with how quickly the help has come and the degree of that help. So they're very happy about that. But as well as that, of course, they're traumatised. Many people are traumatised. They're putting on a brave face, for sure. But, yeah, you can see they're doing it tough. For example, one lady that I spent time with the other day at her house, she's had to move her bed out onto the veranda because she just can't sleep inside because it's really smelly and muddy and everything like that. And while she was asleep on the veranda the other night, somebody went and looted the house next door. And she felt really bad because she didn't wake up. So there's all sorts of things going on.
You obviously do this as your day job, but you're also in Cairns. Were you surprised by the amount of rain?
I was. I really, really was, yes. I mean, we expect a lot of rain. And it obviously was raining during the cyclone. That tends to be horizontal rain. So it gets into places, and you find leaks in your house where you never normally would get rain if it's not associated with really strong winds. So we got all that, and then it sort of quietened down a bit. The wind died off a bit, and then the other rain started. Just continued to get heavier and heavier and heavier and just didn't stop. And we were all watching the radar and checking out the synoptic situation and could see what was going on. But we were just surprised that the system didn't move. It just sat over us. Persisted. And that was the surprising thing. And yeah, it was, I described to someone by text down the coast, I said, this is just going ballistic here. This is unbelievable. I can't believe what's happening.
So we knew about this cyclone. There was a lot of warning about that. But can you explain how Cairns ended up with such intense rain without a lot of warning?
Well, yes. Obviously, we can expect a lot of rain from a tropical cyclone crossing the coast, but especially if you're on the southern side of the cyclone, because there the winds are coming on shore. They're bringing the water vapour in off the warm tropical sea, the Coral Sea. And so we always expect a lot of rain. The cyclone passed to the north of Cairns, sort of between Daintree or Cape Tribulation and Woodjill Woodjill. We naturally expect to get a lot of rain in that situation. We then expected the cyclone to cross the Cape and go into the Gulf of Carpentaria, probably at the speed that it was approaching the coast, but it didn't. It slowed down. So that just allowed the rain, you know, the winds coming from the northeast and other winds coming from the southeast to converge. We've got quite a steep escarpment, 400 to 600 metres generally along the back of the Cairns coast. That causes orographic uplift, so that adds to the rainfall. So that was a major contributing factor. And then a mid-level trough developed and moved eastwards towards the coast, and then it sat straight over Cairns. And that trough started to intensify. And that's really what generated that tremendous amount of really intense rainfall for, you know, nearly 24 hours. So, yeah, it was those things combined which produced the record-breaking rains and flood.
Is all the water gone now? Has it all made it out to sea? Is that where it's headed?
Yes, yes, generally. I mean, you know, being in the wettest zone in Australia, we have what's known as a very high drainage density. So we have a very large network of streams, tributaries feeding into the main streams, etc. So the landscape is used to getting a lot of rain. I mean, you know, Cairns gets a average rainfall of a bit over 2 metres. The Daintree gets 4 metres. But some places around here get up to 7 metres of rain, and that can just be in a normal year. The water does flow off, but we hadn't had rain for a good couple of months before that, and everything was very dry. So we realised that the catchment was soaking it up a fair bit. We thought that might save us, but the amount of rain just, you know, overpowered that. And the runoff occurred, and, yeah, it all rushed into the rivers and rose, you know, fairly rapidly, really, throughout Sunday and into Sunday afternoon.
You mentioned that it's been dry before this point, and it is meant to be El Nino. Is it surprising to get flooding like this when it is meant to be dry?
Yes, it is. I mean, it's not unheard of, you know. I mean, of course, the size of the floods that we've got are biggest in over 100 years, so we certainly wouldn't have expected something like that. I mean, an El Nino just means that you've probably got less chance of getting big rains, but you can still get them. Now, there are other climate drivers besides El Nino that come into play along the east coast of Australia. This wasn't monsoonal rain either. You know, the monsoon hadn't set in yet, so the cyclone had formed in sort of different conditions that we would normally get our cyclones developing in. So that was unusual, and especially to get a cyclone so early in the season, in December, those things were unusual. So, yeah, I guess all of it was unusual. But, you know, it can occur. So it's not something that we would think could never occur.
How much can we attribute any of this to climate change and just the general change in the environment?
Well, a lot of people are going to say, I think, in the months ahead that, we've had these events in the past. Indeed, we've had bigger events in the past. We know that prior to the gauging stations going in Cairns, we know there was some big floods in 1911 and 1913. There were some big floods in the 1800s, which wiped out the original settlement of Smithfield, which was sort of one of the major centres in Cairns in the late 1800s. So we've had some big events in the past. So sure, these events can occur with or without climate change, but the key point is, and something that we can't overlook, is that we've got more moisture in the atmosphere now. That's indisputable. You know, we know that for sure. And that must play a role. It has to play a role. If we've got more moisture in the atmosphere, then there's simply more there to be able to dump down. And what we're seeing all around the world is that rainfall events are getting more intense, and particularly rainfall events that are occurring in association with tropical cyclones. And it's not always the most intense cyclones that are doing it either. I mean, Jasper was only a Category 2 when it crossed the coast, so that's normally not that big a deal, you know, in terms of what some cyclones can be like both here and right across tropical Australia and elsewhere around the globe. But some of these weaker cyclones are producing a lot of rain, a lot more than we ever would have expected. Again, all of this behaviour is starting to suggest that climate change is playing a role in this. I'm not saying that it's totally responsible for these events, but I think definitely that climate change is starting to play a role in this.
Jonathan Knott, a professor of geoscience at James Cook University in Cairns. The war in Gaza reached an horrific milestone this week, with the territory's health ministry announcing the death toll has now passed 20,000. Around the world, many of us have been watching this war play out on social media. Truly distressing images of bombed homes and bloodied bodies are easy to find. And while the vast majority are real images, tech experts say they've seen a rise in AI-generated pictures and video. Of course, propaganda is nothing new, but with one third of the world due to vote in elections in the next year, there's growing concern about the impact of deep fakes and what they could do to our democracy. Hani Farid is a digital forensics expert at the University of California.
Well, here's what I can tell you is, as compared to 2 years ago at the start of the Ukraine conflict, we are seeing way more manipulated images, manipulated audio, and manipulated video coming out of Gaza today. I think there's a number of reasons for it. One is in the intervening 2 years, the technology has just gotten better. The ability now to create hyper-photorealistic images by simply typing in a prompt has gotten very good. And there are services out there now, half a dozen of them, that are very easy to use. That's number one. Number two is, I think I'm going to state the obvious, this is a very emotional and very difficult time. And so when we are in these particularly emotional times, there is an incentive to try to create propaganda or to push a particular narrative. And number three, and this one's important, and we shouldn't forget this, because this is not fundamentally just a propaganda issue or just an AI issue, but the social media companies have fallen asleep at the wheel again. Major social media companies have eviscerated their trust and safety teams. Twitter, of course, is the worst offender in the space, but all of them are doing worse and worse job at moderating disinformation on their platforms.
And it also just throws everything into doubt, doesn't it? Because we have to be clear here. I mean, the vast majority of images we're seeing out of Gaza are real, but do a few of these doctored images make people question everything?
Yeah, this is the right question. When we live in a world where you either see or know that it's possible for images and audio and video to be faked, well, then everything's in doubt, right? And so even if 1%, 0.5%, 0.1% of the images coming out of Gaza are fake, it casts a very, very long shadow. And suddenly everything becomes suspect. And that's what's sort of dangerous, is that it becomes very difficult to reason about what's happening, even if the majority of the content, and I believe that the majority of the images we're seeing are real, but because people have a particular side they want to be on, they're more skeptical of things that don't conform to their beliefs or their narrative. Of course, both sides of the conflict are pushing a particular narrative, and as are other political parties. And so it's all very messy. And as if it wasn't bad enough to try to figure out how to reason about what's happening in this region, now we have casting doubt on everybody and anything that we see.
And of course, it's not just this conflict. A third of the world's population vote in the next year. How concerning are these kinds of images for the future of democracy and elections?
I don't think this is hyperbolic to say this, is that we are already seeing disinformation broadly, but also deep fakes interfere with our elections in Slovakia, in Argentina, in Brazil, in Mexico, in India, here in the US. We are seeing all forms of fraud and misinformation and disinformation and deepfakes. And as the technology gets better and better and better, we are going to see that increasing. Understand something also, that most of the elections we are talking about, the margins are very thin. Here in the United States, our last two U.S. national elections, the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans can be measured in tens of thousands of votes. You don't have to swing millions of people. And you don't have to swing millions of people for months or years. You can swing tens of thousands of people over a 48-hour period, and you can move a national election that impacts the entire world.
We've obviously seen misinformation play a role in the last few elections, but do you see the pictures as particularly insidious? I mean, that old adage of a picture's worth a thousand words.
I would say the videos and the audio are particularly insidious because I do think that for a long time we have had confidence in them. And maybe we've grown weary and leery of, okay, I see something on Twitter, maybe I'm going to pause. I think not enough people do, but that's a secondary issue. But when you see a video of a presidential candidate or a president for that matter saying something, that really resonates with us. That has a sticking power. And there is good evidence from the social science literature that when you try to correct the record, so let's say I see a video of President Biden saying something inappropriate, and eventually that record gets straightened. A week later, I sort of forget. I forget. I'm like, oh, there was some controversy, but I don't remember. Setting the record straight is incredibly complicated. But the other issue that's very difficult here is that when those images and videos go online, the half-life of a social media post can be measured in minutes, which means half of all views happen in about 2 minutes. So even by the time you correct the record, we don't even know if people are going to see it. And even if they see it, it doesn't really stick. And so I think you're absolutely right that there is something very compelling about these images and audio and video, because we're not accustomed to how to deal with this world where things can be manipulated so realistically.
There are quite a few companies that are trying to work in this space and trying to stamp out these fakes. How well do they work, and are they possibly keeping up with the tech?
Well, understand that in my world of detecting manipulated media, we are always playing catch up. The way my world works is my adversary, the ones creating this stuff, gets to work in silence for as long as they want, and then they release their product. And then my starter gun goes off, and now I've got to play catch up. And while I'm doing that, they're building their next version. So we are fundamentally playing catch up. There's two ways to detect manipulated media, what we call reactive and proactive. Reactive is we wait. We wait for something harmful to show up online. It eventually shows up on my desk. We analyze it. We try to set the record straight. But as I just enumerated, that can be very, very difficult. So it's mostly in a postmortem. The proactive techniques say, okay, we are an AI generation company. We understand that there are creative and interesting things to do with our content, but we also understand there are going to be used for harm, non-consensual sexual imagery, fraud, disinformation. So we are going to watermark and fingerprint every single piece of content that we produce so that downstream, when they show up in somebody's browser or somebody's phone, they can be automatically detected quickly and accurately, and then we can decide what the intervention is at that point. There are efforts along the way. I think they will solve part of the problem, but not all of the problem. There are going to be bad actors out there who decide, well, we don't care if people do bad things with it. In fact, we encourage it. There are many, many open source software where we can't control what people do with it. So I'm encouraged by the technology that will intervene, but also understand that we need better policy, we need regulation, we need liability, we need the public to get better at understanding how to be a discerning digital citizen, and we need the social media companies to start taking this stuff seriously, which they have not done for the last 20 years.
Is there more that can be done at a government level to regulate it, or is it just the Wild West because it's the internet?
It's a big world out there. So look, the U.S. can decide. We are going to start regulating this, but we are 5% of the world's population. What do you do with the rest, the 7.5 billion other people in the world? It's a big internet out there. And I think a single government can do a little bit, but not a lot. So I think that there are things that we can do to encourage, particularly here in the U.S. and in Western countries, to the companies to do better. But fundamentally, I think we are going to be limited because of the nature of the internet and that, in fact, that it is borderless. That's not to say we shouldn't do things. That's not to say we shouldn't think about how to put guardrails on this. But it is significantly more challenged given the nature of the fact that we are talking about speech and information, and we are talking about a big, wide-open internet.
Hani Farid from the University of California. Well, the conflict in the Middle East is also impacting on the Red Sea and affecting global supply chains. The Red Sea is one of the world's most important waterways. Around 50 cargo ships travel through it every day. But since the Israel-Gaza war, boats in the Red Sea have come under increasing attacks from Yemen's Houthi militants. The Houthis are aligned with Iran and have been eager to show their support for Hamas in Gaza. This week, the US announced a naval protection force known as Operation Prosperity Guardian to ward off attacks and ask the international community for help. The Australian government has decided not to send a warship, as requested by the White House. Instead, it will provide defence personnel.
We're one of the 39 countries in the combined maritime force. We are making a contribution there. We've said that we'll examine further personnel as well being there. And the US is keen for Australian diplomatic and public support.
Back in 2021, a cargo ship blocked the Suez Canal, causing major disruption to global supply chains. So what impact will these attacks have?
The Suez Canal, the Red Sea in general, are really crucial shipping routes because it really slashes how long it takes for containers and other goods to get from, say, Asia to Europe to North America. It's a crucial venue, really, for those sorts of trades.
Rachel Premack is a logistics reporter at FreightWaves.
So globally, 30% of all container volumes in the world actually goes through the Suez Canal.
So in recent weeks, we've seen an increase in attacks by Houthis. Can you give me a bit of a sense of what has been happening?
Yeah, so Houthi fighters based in Yemen have been firing drones and missiles at these vessels in these vital shipping lanes, as well as just more generally at Israel. And as a result, in response to this sort of aggression, we've seen major European shipping giants like Maersk, Hapag-Lloyd, BP Oil, all announce a suspension of travel. And instead of going through the Red Sea and through the Suez Canal, they are preferring to go all the way around the bottom of Africa, around the bottom of the Cape of Good Hope, just to avoid the Suez Canal and some of the dangers and disruptions there.
So what is that likely to mean for global supply chains?
What this means is that we're going to see a major delay in a lot of these ocean shipping moves. We'll see a cost increase just because of these delays. One analyst actually estimated that there will be a $400,000 to $1 million cost increase per ship thanks to the longer journey. So instead of going through the Red Sea, through the Suez Canal, we're seeing a 16-day increase to move goods to India. We're seeing a 17-day increase to move goods to the Mediterranean and a 5-day increase to move goods through Singapore due to some other sort of shipping delays going on internationally.
So it's clearly not going to impact Christmas, but do we have a sense of when we'll start noticing the disruption?
So it's interesting because at this time, it's almost a positive time, you could almost say, for these shipping delays, because typically in the month of January, you see a slowdown in manufacturing in China amid the Lunar New Year holiday. But after that, there's a really big uptick of manufacturing of goods going out of East Asia. And if that delay is still happening, if these canals are still disrupted, then this would certainly start to sort of trickle down to consumers within probably about a month and a half or 2 months.
So this week, the US Secretary of Defense announced a naval protection force.
These attacks are reckless, dangerous, and they violate international law. And I would remind you that this is not just a US issue. This is an international problem, and it deserves an international response.
Will greater military protection in the area help, or are shipping companies just not willing to risk it?
I think it could help. I think if you are, let's say, a Maersk or a CMA CGM, you might feel more comfortable knowing that you've got this larger combined naval task force escorting ships through this canal. And it's important to note that many shipping companies are still operating through the Suez Canal, especially those ocean carriers based in Asia. They are still going through the Suez Canal, going through the Red Sea. But, you know, for a company, for some of these ocean carriers, they just don't want to risk it, both for the cargo on board, but also for the people working on those ships. There's also a lot of insurance issues. Not the typical insurance policy doesn't exactly cover, you know, acts of war. They might be more keen to cover hurricanes or typhoons. So it's both costly and really dangerous for certain ocean carriers to move through this area. And they might just say, you know, even with all of this naval power, we're just going to stick with this more lengthy and convoluted route.
Is there ever a point where air freight or something else becomes a smarter option, or is just moving stuff via ship so much cheaper?
Yeah, unfortunately, air cargo is really costly for most goods, especially when you think about, you know, furniture, for example. That's going to be something very heavy. It's going to take up a lot of space on a plane very quickly. But for perhaps more high value and lighter goods, let's say a batch of semiconductors or, you know, precious metals, that might make more sense to move via air cargo, but it's just multiples more expensive to move via air cargo.
Logistics journalist Rachel Premack. And that's our episode for the week. And actually, it's our last episode ever. This show started back in 2020 as a way to explain the news around COVID and slowly morphed into a show trying to explain the news of the week. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you've learned something. We hope you've enjoyed it. Thanks also to the two hosts of the show over the years, Linda Mottram and David Lipson, for their wisdom and general inquisitiveness about things. Thanks also to producer Nell Whitehead, who's been here with me since the start, and all the other producers and presenters who've filled in along the way. If you're looking for something to listen to over the summer, I recommend a pod called Quick Smart. They're all short episodes tackling everything from the disappearance of Agatha Christie to why we haven't got driverless cars. But also, don't unsubscribe from this feed. We'll be back with something in the new year. This episode was produced by Lara Corrigan, Anna John, and me, Madeline Jenner. Catch you next time.